Phenomenal Albert Collins wailing away on his trusty Fender Telecaster, that's his guitar, with If Trouble Was Money from his 1993 album, The Best of Albert Collins. Collins was interested initially in the piano, but the great blues man, John Lee Hooker, changed all that for him. In turn, he was influenced and has influenced many noted blues guitar players with his new and unique style of playing. Albert Collins was performing in Switzerland in 1993 when he suddenly took ill. He was diagnosed with lung cancer that had spread to his liver and given only 4 months to live, but he insisted on completing his final album. He died on November the 24th, 1993, at age 61. Ironically, at the 38th Grammy Awards in 1996. He posthumously was nominated in the category of Best Blues Contemporary Album. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, January the 30th, and today, a special presentation on a word President Obama rarely uses, except in the context of U.S. foreign aid to developing nations, and that word is poverty. 50 million Americans have little or no income. They are poor. And an estimated equal number depend on government-subsidized food programs to sustain themselves and their families. Poverty is epidemic in America. Today we are having a briefing on poverty by way of author Sasha Abramski, who has written several books and papers and articles on the subject. His current work, The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives, serves as an update to the misery index on this large and growing segment of America that 50 years after President Lyndon B. Johnson's declaration of a war on poverty remains largely unheard and unseen despite vigorous advocacy and intervention. Sasha teaches writing at the University of California, Davis, and is a fellow at Demos, a progressive think tank based in Manhattan. He has written several acclaimed books, papers, and articles, as I've said before, and is with us for the second time. He has written, among other books, The Breadline USA, The Hidden Scandal of American Hunger and How to Fix It, American Furies, Crime, Punishment, and Vengeance in the Age of Mass Imprisonment, Conned, How Millions Went to Prison, Lost the Vote, and Sent George W. Bush to the White House, and Hard Times, How Politics Built a Prison Nation. Thanks, Sasha, for being with us today.
Chris, thanks for having me on your show again.
Thank you. So what we will be doing, I'm just informing the audience, Sasha Abramski will make his presentation for about 30 to 35 minutes, and then we'll open up the phone lines for your questions and comments. Okay, Sasha, you're on.
Thank you, Eutrice. 50 years ago, President Lyndon Johnson launched what was called the War on Poverty. It was an America that was living the age of affluence. In the decades since World War II had ended, America as a whole had grown wealthier. The economy had grown. The country was thriving in many ways as it never had previously. And yet there was something that the social activist Michael Harrington listed as the other America. It was an America left out of affluence. It was an America bedeviled by hunger, by homelessness, by lack of access to health care, by malnutrition, by children going to school with no shoes on their feet, children going to school with no breakfast in their bellies. Johnson had read The Other America, and he recognized that it was a crisis. He recognized that it was a moral catastrophe. And in 1964, in the State of the Union, he committed the moral energies and the economic energies and the political energies of the federal government of the United States to tackling the crisis of poverty. He set in place a series of innovative reforms, channeling grants to local communities, giving local communities better access to food programs, increasing access to affordable health care. And in the years after that speech, many, many millions of Americans were given a degree of economic security that had previously eluded them. It became fashionable, because poverty was not entirely eliminated in these years, to say that the war on poverty had failed. If, however, you were one of the millions of Americans who now had access to more affordable health care if you were elderly, to more affordable food if you were young and poor, to a Head Start program if you were a family from low income and you wanted your children to have early education, if you were one of those Americans, the war on poverty did not fail. And yet, in the decades since, as a country, we took our eye off the ball. From the mid-1970s on in, poverty began increasing at startling rates. And as it did so, inequality, the wealth gap between those at the top of the economy and those at the bottom of the economy, expanded as well. Today, in the year 2014, we have a wealth gap bigger than at any time in the last 85 years. We have a level of poverty that is condemning 50 million Americans, 1 in 6 Americans, to living below the poverty line. We have a higher level of child poverty than any other advanced first world democracy. Earlier this week, President Obama used his State of the Union, 50 years after Lyndon Johnson's famous speech, to define poverty and the growing wealth gap as the central great domestic challenge of our age. Obama is right in identifying this. For if we do not tackle poverty, if we do not tackle inequality, the kind of a country that we are and the kind of a country that we will become will resemble something fundamentally different from the America of previous generations. The levels of inequality that we are now seeing represent a fundamental threat to a country based around ideals of aspiration and upward mobility. I want to today talk to you about some of the people whom I have met as I have traveled around America from state to state over the last several years, exploring the textures of 21st century American poverty. Many of these stories can be found in my book, The American Way of Poverty. Some of them can be found in articles that I've written for magazines and for newspapers. I want to now introduce you to some of the men and the women whom I met around the country as they told me their stories, what poverty meant for them, what it meant for them economically, what it meant for them materially, what it meant for them psychologically. The first person I want you to meet is Mary Vasquez. When I met her in late 2011, Mary was 67 years old. She worked for a Walmart outside Dallas, Texas. She was not a well woman. She had heart trouble, diabetes. She had suffered bouts with cancer. She had high blood pressure and spinal problems. She was paid about $10 an hour. I asked her what she ate. She said when she could afford it, she would get 88 cents television dinners. When she couldn't afford it, she would go to bed hungry. Mary was too ill to take public transport to work. She did not know how to drive. And so out of her meager paycheck, she was having to pay neighbors gas money to drive her to and from work. Halfway across the country, back in California, in Stockton, I met a man called Matthew Joseph. Matthew was a steel worker, a middle-aged man, a deacon at his church, and he had bought a home during the boom years in the early part of the 21st century. When I met him, he had suffered a double catastrophe. First, his house had collapsed in value with the collapse in value of the broader housing market, and then he had been called into his office one day and told that because of the recession, he was out of a job. In his 50s, he did not know how he could afford to house his family. He did not know how he could afford to keep his family fed and to give them all of the basics that provide a dignity to life. Nor could he renegotiate a loan on his house because his house was now underwater. I asked him how he felt. And Matthew Joseph said, I went home and I curled up in a fetal position on my bed and I began to cry. I now want to introduce you to Luann Prokop from Appalachian, Pennsylvania. Luann was a middle-aged accountant. She, too, at the start of the recession, lost her job. She had worked her whole life. She had thought of herself as middle class. She had defined her aspirations as middle class. She was looking forward to a retirement 15 or 20 years down the line. She lost her job, and she spent 2 years looking for work. She ran through her savings. She, too, started skipping meals. She had to tell her children that she could no longer afford to buy them the things that they had previously taken for granted. anxious, nervous about her future, she began losing weight. When I met her, she had finally found work, but it paid one-third of what her previous job had paid. She said she would never be able to afford to retire. I'll now introduce you to Angela Urquiaga. Angela is a homeless counselor at a large high school in North Las Vegas, just a few miles from the fabled Las Vegas Strip. I was told I should meet her by the school principal. And when he said that they had a homeless counselor, I raised an eyebrow. It struck me as an extraordinary thing for a school to have. I met Angela, and I asked her what she did. She said her full-time job was counseling students at the school who were homeless. And I said, well, how many do you have? And Angela said, at the start of the recession, we had about 20. By 2010, we had over 100. By 2011, it was over 150. Nearly 10% of the students at the school that Angela Urquiaga worked at were homeless, many of them living in church basements, couch surfing from friend to friend and relative to relative. Some of them had spent time living literally in cars or on the streets. And I asked her who their parents were, and she said many of them were people who had had jobs, and when the recession hit, they had lost their jobs, and over time, the families had lost their homes. I want to introduce you now to Vicenta Delgada. I met her on a food line in North Philadelphia on a cold, chilly, late autumn day. Delgada was very ill. She had cancer, and she needed nutritional supplements that were not covered by her Medicaid. I asked her how much time she spent on the food lines, and she said every Saturday morning. The pantry opened at about 11 o'clock, but by 7 or 7:30, there was a line of hundreds of people snaking around the block, waiting for food. Waiting for food because that was the only opportunity they had to feed themselves and their families. And Vicenta would get there every weekend, and she would sit in the cold, bundled up against the chill in her coat, waiting and waiting for the doors to open and for her bags of free food. The final person I want to introduce you to is a woman I met recently in Oakland, California, named Shonda Roberts. Shonda works for a fast food company. She's 38, and she earns $8 an hour. She works about 25 to 30 hours a week, and after taxes, she brings home about $500 a month. I said to Shonda, how do you pay your bills? She said, I give every penny of my income to my landlord. And I said to her, how do you eat? She said, I get food stamps. Shonda works for a large company, and yet she is too poor to buy her own food. Now, to me, these stories that I've told you, these people whom I have met around the country, represent a scandal rather than a tragedy. A tragedy is an accident of nature. A tragedy is something that we human beings can do nothing about. A tragedy happens, causes pain, and we think how sad, and then we move on. A scandal, by contrast, is the consequence of human choice, of human action or inaction. That 50 million Americans in a country as affluent as America live in poverty represents a startling failure of our moral imagination. That we have allowed almost one in four of our children to live in poverty is, I believe, a catastrophe of historic proportions. What makes this scandal worse is it doesn't have to be. There are solutions to this. We know there are solutions. We know that there is work to be done to rebuild our public infrastructure, to rebuild bridges that need to be repaired and levees that need to be repaired, to shore up our environment and our shorelines. And yet, at the height of the unemployment crisis, we did not create public works programs to bring the unemployed back into the labor force. We know that education is a pathway out of poverty. And yet, over the last few years, higher education has become increasingly unaffordable. K-12 education has become increasingly ramshackle as states and localities have struggled to balance their bills. and preschool, which in many countries is now a universal, still remains out of reach for far too many children. We could fix that. We could pass laws mandating universal preschool. We could invest properly in our K-12 system. And we could create social insurance mechanisms. In my book, I call one an educational opportunity fund that would spread the risk around the cost of higher education, that would make higher education more affordable for almost everybody. We could and we should have an honest conversation about taxes, not because taxes are a good in and of themselves, but because an adequate tax base is necessary to funding a public infrastructure that will generate opportunity for all. And yet, that conversation is not being had. The wealth gap that exists today is a wealth gap in part because of the poverty at the bottom of the economy, but in part because of the extraordinary stampede of wealth toward the top of the economy. We have more billionaires than we have ever had before. We have a stock market doing extraordinarily well. We have corporate profits at a level that we haven't seen in 70 years. And yet, we continually see that at the top of the economy, the tax burden is going down. Were we to have an honest conversation about taxes, we could create Robin Hood pools of income that could be used to generate anti-poverty programs in rural areas, in urban areas, wherever that need arises. We know that housing is a critical part of the story around American poverty. And yet in recent years, we have systematically underinvested in building new affordable housing units. We need to do more on that. We need to build those units, and we need to find creative ways to keep people at risk of foreclosure who are trying to pay their bills in their homes. And we need expanded nutritional assistance. We know that when children go to school hungry, they underperform academically. We know that when adults try to look for work hungry, it makes it harder for them to find and to keep employment. And yet the conversation in Washington these days is about how many billions or how many tens of billions of dollars can be cut from food stamps. Well, if you cut tens of billions of dollars from food stamps, there are real life consequences, because the men and women who are impacted and the children who are impacted are real people, not abstract cardboard cutout caricatures. And those real people, Mary Vasquez's of the world, the Shonda Roberts of the world, the children that Angela Urquiaga works with in the North Las Vegas High School, those real people need adequate access to food. And that the richest country in the world is having a conversation now about how to limit nutritional assistance for its most vulnerable and needy part of the population, again, strikes me as something of a scandal. The scale of the crisis of poverty in 21st century America is, it seems, corroding much that is most valuable and best in this country's heritage. It is reshaping the country in profoundly disturbing ways. For too many years, it has been impolite conversation to talk about poverty and to talk about the cascading crisis of ever-growing inequality in America. It was seen as somehow outside the mainstream, as somehow impolite. Now people are talking about it, from the left to the right, from liberals to conservatives. Poverty is now on the agenda. Obama, over the last few months, has given a series of speeches in which he lays out the gravity of the issue, lays out the scale of the crisis that we now confront. We no longer can say we did not know it existed. We know it exists. And knowing it exists, our challenge now is to act to reverse these trends. That challenge is, I believe, the moral imperative of our moment. Thank you for listening. And I do hope that you phone in now with questions, with comments, with suggestions and with ideas about how to tackle the crises of poverty and ever-growing inequality in 2014 America. Again, my name is Sasha Abramski, and you've been listening to me this past half hour discuss the American way of poverty.
Thank you. Thank you, Sasha. We'll take this short musical break. Return to our music of the day with Albert Collins, and we'll come back to your questions and comments at 888-874-4888. Late Albert Collins with If Trouble Were Money. He says he'd be a millionaire. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Utrice Lead. Our guest, Sasha Abramski, who has just delivered a very riveting presentation on poverty in America. We have Anthony from New Jersey. You're on with Sasha Abramski.
How you doing?
Good, Anthony. How are you?
I'm good. My thing is, I would say that, well, what I'm going to do this year to help out is, I like to plant a garden every year, but what I'm going to do is, in front of my house this year, I'm going to put together like probably like 5 tomato plants, probably 5 pepper plants, with a sign out there, if you need food or need help, please take free food. And that's my way of giving back, and then I also have stacks of Feed the Deaf to hand out to people, too. So I say that's the easy way to do it. It's very inexpensive to grow your own food. That's why I don't understand why hospitals and schools don't have gardens on top of their roofs that can supply food for the school, that can supply food for the hospitals, and it'll be fresh, organic, locally grown food. And that's an easy way to get food out to people. So my thing is, I'm going to do that in front of my own house, and hopefully other people catch on to it and do it themselves, and it'd be a way to give food to the community. Thank you.
Anthony,
thanks
I think,
a lot.
I think that's a great response. I do think that the food issue is a really important part of this component, because there are too many people who are hungry and too many people who live very far from affordable food outlets. And the food outlets they are close to tend not to sell healthy food. The idea of increasing sufficiency around food is something that's taking off all over the country, and you see it in rural areas, but even more interestingly, you see it in urban areas in places like Detroit, where people have basically taken it into their own hands and they've started growing organically. They've started growing food around the country. And it's a really interesting, very locally based response to poverty. And so I do think that what you're saying makes a lot of sense there.
Ali from New York, you're on the air.
Okay. Hi, Sasha. I just have to say this. The narrative about with the media is that the people that they have lost their houses is always, especially the right wing, but it's very hard here in New York when you talk to people that the first thing that they tell you is that these people have lost their houses because they were greedy. And who they're talking about being greedy and people that they couldn't afford houses, they always talk about, of course, the Latinos and the blacks. But the people that you just, you gave the name of this gentleman, Matthew, that you said he was a deacon, and then you gave the, also you were talking about this woman who was in accounting, and then this woman, Angela, who is also, who works as a social worker. These people, they're people that had degrees, I believe, most of them, at least two of them, in order to perform those jobs. So right now, how can we, when people approach us and always talk about the people that they bought these houses that they couldn't afford the houses, what would be the thing that we could, a good response to, towards those people? But another thing that I wanted to say, I would like for you to give your email, if it's possible, because I'm part of two groups in Occupy Wall Street, and one of them will meet on Sunday, and I, you will be a perfect person to come and talk to the group about your book and about, you know, poverty. And I would like for you to give the information if it's possible. What I do is with one of the groups that I belong to, we actually are fighting for the minimum wage, to be the minimum wage here in New York, $50 an hour. We do a lot of protesting in front of a lot of the stores in New York. And I also sometimes I, you know, when I can, when we could afford it, you know, give one of the churches here, they do, they have a food pantry, and sometimes we are able to give a bag full of food. Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, on the second point first, what I would say is, rather than me giving my email out publicly on the air, if you send something to Utris Leeds' office, she'll forward it to me. And the work you're doing sounds fascinating, so I'd be happy to communicate with you about that. On the issue of how do we talk about the fact that people aren't in trouble just because they're greedy or just because they're making bad choices, but they're in trouble because of systemic failures that have gone on in the economy. I think the way you talk about it is you bring in the stories of real people, the people I mentioned, the people I write about. When you start actually listening to their voices and you start hearing their stories, they become human beings in the minds of an audience. And I've always thought that as a journalist, whatever you're writing about, you communicate best with an audience if you tell a story in a way that humanizes the people you're writing about. And the audiences basically grapple with ideas better, and they think about ideas in a more complex way if you can put a human face to the story. And I think one of the things that happened in the last 30, 40 years in our national conversation about poverty, and it predates the housing crisis, and it predates all of the calamities of 2008-09, but one of the things that happened was we increasingly lost the language of empathy in our political public discourse. And we allowed for a very nasty rhetoric to take a hold, especially around poverty and especially around deep poverty. And when you get to the deepest poverty, people on welfare, people on public assistance of one sort or another, at the very bottom of the economic ladder, what we saw in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s was a language both in Washington, D.C., but also in the media, especially on talk radio, that went out of its way to demonize, to humiliate, to castigate poor people for their poverty. And I think one of the things that we have to do as a country, as we have this conversation about poverty, and as we have this conversation about responses to poverty, we have to get beyond the stereotypes. Because as long as we're trying to craft public policy and the people we're talking about are seen as stereotypes,
we're going to get nowhere. But once we talk about people as real people, and once we bring those real people into the conversation, so we're not just talking about poverty, but we're talking with people in poverty about solutions, once that happens, then it seems to me we get a much more nuanced debate and a much more nuanced conversation. And that's when we're going to get interesting solutions.
888-874-4888. I want to ask about the recent good news, they said, that there seems to have been a compromise with respect to the farm bill. And the compromise is that they're only going to lop off $10 billion from the food stamp program. Now, does that seem to you to be ridiculous and objectionable, especially since the position I think that the, especially the Democrats should take, or any person of conscience should take, is that there should be no compromise on what people need?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about food stamps, it's the one part of the safety net that still responds fairly quickly and fairly accurately to increases in poverty. The welfare system no longer does. 40 years ago, four in five families with kids who were in poverty were able to access welfare, the AFDC program. And then that was changed in the 1990s to what's called TANF, Temporary Aid to Needy Families. And now only one in four poor families with kids accesses cash welfare. So if you're looking at a part of the social safety net that responds quickly to increases in poverty, it's not the welfare system anymore. But it is food stamps, because anybody who's at a certain income threshold or below who applies for food stamps and is legally resident in the country is eligible to get them. So the reason we have 47 million people on food stamps at the moment is because by government own measure, there are 47 million people in this country who are poor enough that without government assistance, they'd be hungry. And when we talk about slicing, and I love the language here, the language is that we're going to slice, as if you can sort of surgically do this and it doesn't hurt anybody, $8 to $10 billion off of food stamps, and that's seen as a compromise. Well, it might be a compromise in the halls of power, but what does it mean on the ground? Well, what it means on the ground is either the people who are getting food stamps are going to get less each month, which means that they're going to have even less margin for error in terms of what they eat and what they buy, or it means that they're going to be fewer people who are rendered eligible. And the only way you can do that is you have to find categories of people who you're no longer going to give food stamps to, whether that's able-bodied adults who are long-term unemployed, or whether it's felons who are permanently disenfranchised from accessing food stamps, permanently removed from accessing food stamps. Well, that's a huge, huge issue. If you say to a category of people, you did something decades ago, and therefore you're going to go hungry, that's a huge thing to say. And so I think when we talk about the consequences of slicing and dicing billions and billions of dollars from the nutritional safety net, really it becomes a moral question. It really does become a moral question. Is this how we want to balance our budget? Clearly, we need to balance our budget. Clearly, we need to do a better job of matching how much revenue we're bringing in to how much we're spending. But do we really want to do that on the backs of hungry people in America? And that, to me, is the question. And so when I read about this compromise, yes, it's good that the farm bill is in place. We needed a farm bill for many different reasons, because the farm bill covers a tremendous part of the national economy. But do we need a farm bill in place that's going to make more people hungry? Well, that to me seems like we're going in totally the wrong direction.
Especially, Sasha, since part of the budget is paid to farmers to not produce food in order
that's
to
right.
stabilize
I mean,
the commodities
this
market.
This goes back all the way to the Great Depression, that the government was looking for ways to shore up agricultural prices. And that was important because there were a tremendous number of destitute farmers in the Great Depression. It was very important for the security of the country as well as the health of the country to make sure that there were farmers in place who could return to growing crops when the market rebounded. So there is some sense to crop subsidies, and there is some sense to paying people to keep land fallow at times. But there's also an awful lot of subsidies these days going to extremely, extremely wealthy agribusiness combines. And that's a conversation that we're not having. If we need to rein in expenditures in this area, surely it would be better to rein in some of the subsidies going to the biggest agribusiness combines in the country rather than rein in the amount of food stamp money going to some of the hungriest and poorest people in the country.
Sherry, you're on the air with Sasha Abramski.
Hi, I have a question. I want to ask Sasha, what role, and Utrice also, what role do you think racism has to do with the way the white middle class sees poverty? Because I've had some white people say stuff to me that I find absolutely incredible, like black people have no discipline. In other words, it's your own fault that black people are poor. And they identify poverty with black or Hispanic, even though there's a lot of white people who are poor. But it's almost like we don't want to do anything for you because it's your own fault.
Yeah, I think that there's a degree of coded race baiting in a lot of the conversations on poverty. And it's misguided for so many different reasons. It's obviously morally misguided. Because even if poverty really was an African-American and a Latino issue in this country, even if it was, which it isn't, that would in no way diminish the moral urgency of tackling poverty. And the second reason it's misguided is it's simply factually wrong. Poverty in this country is as complicated as American demography itself. Poverty in this country is black, but it's also white. It's urban, but it's also rural. It's young, but it's also old. It transcends boundaries. And this is one of the things I realized as I was going around the country interviewing people. You see it in all corners of this country. Yes, you see it in inner city areas. And yes, you see it in areas historically impoverished like the Mississippi Delta. But you also see it in suburban tract housing. You also see it in areas that look and feel eminently middle class, and yet there are neighbors on those streets who surreptitiously get up early every Saturday morning and go to the food bank because they run through their savings in the aftermath of the economic crisis. So for many, many reasons, it seems to me a completely morally ridiculous stance to say, well, we can't talk about poverty because poverty is a black thing or a brown thing. It is wrong on so many levels to do that.
I agree. From Los Angeles, DX, you're on the air.
Hello, Utrice, and hello, Mr. Abramski. How are
hello.
You?
Hello.
All right. I wanted to, what I had to say, I'll make a couple of comments and then have you kind of expound on it. What I had to say kind of dovetails with what the last caller said, but you mentioned that people have been basically conditioned in this country over the last 30 years or so to demonize the poor and pretty much hate the poor, and that's true. But what I find more shocking is that working people have been conditioned basically to think they're not worthy of anything better. I was watching this documentary, excellent documentary, with features Robert Reich, the ex-labor secretary under Clinton. It's called Inequality for All. And so he's sitting there, and he's talking with these employees of a power plant. And I hear people on there saying things like, well, you know, the CEOs that make all the millions of dollars in this company, I think they deserve it. One guy was saying that cutting employees makes the business more profitable, and it'll help all of us. And another guy is saying that, you know, if and these are mostly white employees, too. Another guy is saying that if I went to college, I would deserve the same kind of salaries they get, but I didn't because I'm not smart enough. And lastly, there was a man on there saying that, well, that company actually treats me better than I even deserve to be treated. I could not believe people are saying things like this. And my point is that people have not only been taught to demonize the poor, but they've put the working class people against the poor and also against their own interests. and I think this is more shocking to me, these white people who are don't even, some of them don't even want to acknowledge that they're even at poverty level, but they are. You know, so maybe you can kind of expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, I think the point you're making is excellent, and I've seen the movie. I thought it was a fascinating movie, and that scene you describe really is quite a disturbing scene for all the reasons that you talked about. I think Barbara Ehrenreich has written about this very well in her book Bait and Switch, and Tom Frank's written about it in What's the Matter with Kansas, that for quite a number of years, a section of working-class America has been essentially given a snow job. They've been told, well, all the problems are the fault of others. And you can take your pick of others. All the problems are the fault of people on welfare. All the problems are the fault of gays. All the problems are the fault of unions. All the fault of the problems are public sector workers. And what it does is it creates this crazy end game where you have people who would benefit tremendously from, let's say, a higher minimum wage, nevertheless voting in a way that guarantees they're not going to get a higher minimum wage. You have people who would benefit tremendously from union organization voting against union representation or voting against public sector employees having union representation, instead of asking, well, why don't I have a good pension or why don't I have good health benefits? The conversation gets shifted and people say, well, I don't have these benefits, therefore why should you? And it's a complete inversion of where the sort of rational discourse on this would be. I think one of the really great challenges of our moment is how do we reverse that? So how do we have a conversation, for example, about the living wage, where instead of people saying, well, I'm only earning $8 an hour, so why should I support somebody else organizing for $15 an hour? The conversation should be, well, how do we get to a point where we're all pushing for decent living wages in our cities and our communities? And this was done 70, 80 years ago when the unions fought for decent pay in the steel foundries and in the mines and in the auto factories. It's why the great blue-collar industries ended up with middle-class incomes. But it took people organizing, and it took an education effort where people came to understand the importance of that kind of organizing in order to get decent wages and decent benefits. And if you fast forward to today, those jobs are disappearing, and the jobs that are coming in are service sector work. And at the moment, that service sector work is very unorganized. It's casualized. And one of the consequences of that is it's very low paid. And so I think one of the great challenges is how do we get people who are working in fast food restaurants, let's say, to think about working together to get decent wages? How do we get hotel workers to think that way? How do we get people in the big box stores, Walmarts and these other big box stores, to think that way? And that's one of the great conversations of the moment, it seems to me.
And I think that the way they've basically conditioned people to think that they're not worthy is why we have a president that can get on TV and brag about raising wage to $10.10, which is still poverty wages. You know,
that actually says very much where we are as a country at the moment, that
right.
That is seen as the most that can be gotten.
Right.
Whereas when you actually look at some cities, you know, Seattle, for example, is now pushing for a $15 living wage. And that actually much more closely approximates what a family needs in order to have a basic level of economic dignity.
Right. And if minimum wage had kept up with inflation, it would be, I think, somewhere around $22 an hour right now, which is where it should be. And it's a disgrace that we're talking about half of that being some sort of triumph. You know, I mean, it's ridiculous.
You know, I've talked about this concept of zero-sum thinking, the idea that any particular benefit, anything that could be described as a benefit to society, automatically cannot be available to all. I mean, no matter what it is, if, for example, food stamps are determined to be a benefit, and they are, not everybody should have them.
Right.
Prosperity, not everybody should enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
So this mindset just permeates policy making. I wanted to ask you, Sasha, have you talked much about the economics of the food programs in terms of what it's not like these people who are receiving benefits are, you know, just running away with the money. This money comes back to the community. Really, it's recycled.
No, that's right. And, you know, in actual fact, it's a very effective way of shoring up local communities. And, you know, again, you go all the way back to the Roosevelt era, all the way back to the 1930s, and there was an awareness that if you had massive levels of concentrated poverty, that poverty served to depress the broader economy because you had a huge number of people who just weren't spending money. And if you could find a way to get money into low-income individuals' wallets and into low-income communities, the money circulated very effectively because all of it was spent. And the same thing holds true today. If you put food stamp money into a community, you allow people to spend more money on food in the groceries, in the grocery store. If they have any cash, you allow them to spend the cash on something else. And at all levels, that money circulates very quickly. And so you see what's called a magnifier effect. So $1 of food stamps actually creates far more than $1 of economic benefit. Now, states realize this. One of the reasons I live in California, and until recently, California had a very, very low food stamp take-up rate. Less than half of the people who were poor enough to qualify for food stamps were actually going ahead, applying for and getting food stamps. And California realized that it was losing billions and billions of dollars a year because of the size of its population and the number of people eligible for food stamps. It was losing billions of dollars a year in potential economic activity. And so it did this sort of full press court, campaigning, publicizing the program, reaching out to poor communities to get a higher enrollment. And it's working. There are now more enrollees going into the program in California. And that's a good thing for many reasons, because if you've got these levels of poverty and you get people more access to food, well, first of all, it's got this economic magnifier effect. But the second thing that happens is it's got a health impact, because if people are eating better, they're less likely to get sick and to have all of these other problems associated with hunger or near hunger. They're less likely to be stressed, and therefore there's going to be fewer mental health problems. So at every level, it economically makes sense for programs like food stamps to be widely accessed. And, you know, conversely, this idea that if you just cut billions and billions of dollars from nutritional assistance, you'll benefit the economy, well, it's not true. All you're doing is you're making poor communities poorer, and you're taking away money that would otherwise circulate in those poor communities.
Which country, as we wrap up, would you say has the most sensible and workable approach to meeting the needs of people who are themselves in need?
Well, I think if you look at, I'm not going to give you a sort of one country answer here. What I will say is if you look at other first world economies, we have lessons that we can draw from in a variety of different places. So, for example, when it came to trying to shore up the labor market, Germany did a pretty good job in the last 5-6 years of using tax laws to provide incentives to companies to not lay people off. If you look at some of the countries in Northern Europe, some of the Scandinavian social democracies, they do a much better job with things like family leave for parents with sick kids. Well, one of the effects of that is it means that if you have a sick kid, you can keep your job. Whereas in this country, oftentimes, if you take time off work to look after a sick child, you lose your job. If you look at some of the countries and the way they distribute health care, well, any country with a single-payer health care system is going to be delivering health care more effectively and more affordably than we do. Now, obviously, we've just gone through this overhaul of how we deliver health care. And more Americans are now going to be covered and have health insurance than was the case previously. But we're still going to have many, many millions of people who, for various reasons, fall outside that and are still going to struggle to get health care that they can afford. So I think that in many, many different areas, we can take examples from different countries. Now, that doesn't mean that we're not doing anything right. There are many, many parts of the American experience that we should be exporting to other countries. There are many things about America that other countries can learn from and take from. But when it comes to poverty, and when it comes to dealing with poverty systemically, and when it comes to preventing so many people becoming impoverished in the first place, this is an area where we're failing, and this is an area where we actually can look abroad or look at local experiments within the United States and pilot programs within the United States, and as a country say, well, we can do better. There are things being done both locally in the United States and in other countries overseas that we could emulate, that we could take lessons from. And I think that's part of being a member of the global community, is that you look around, you see who's doing what right, and you share information and you share knowledge, and hopefully over time you emerge as a better country as a result of that.
Sasha Abramski, author of The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives. Thanks for being with us today. Really insightful. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. It was really a joy to be on.
Thanks. Well, this brings us close to the end of our program today. Tomorrow, you do not want to miss tomorrow's program. I'm telling you, you don't want to miss it. So be with us tomorrow at the same time. And tune in. Tell others to tune in, too. We need to grow this station, but I'm championing my own program, too. I need to broaden our audience and get more people listening in, get more points of view we can cross-pollinate with, and have people have access to a medium that truly tries to do the right thing of bringing you information you will not get anywhere else. Thanks so much for being with us today. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Mike Feder with Occupied Territory America. Oh, and you could reach me at Lead Stories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com, and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Albert Collins, going home.